The following audio is from Park Church in Denver, Colorado. More information about Park Church is available online at parkchurchdenver.org.
Like he said, I'm Lauren, and I've been married to Andy for about 11 years. And we have four kiddos. You probably see them running around downstairs and me not talking to anybody because I'm chasing them the whole time. But I would love to get a hand. I want to see who's here since I haven't gotten to go to any of the other talks. Who's dating? Way to go. And you're dating. And then engaged. And the rest are married with kids. Good job, John. Does anybody else have kids besides the grandparents that have? Well, isn't there a couple that?
There's a couple that are here.
All right. So, like I said, he asked me to do three topics. So to tie it all together, I try to find one theme to kind of tie it and push it through. But first, I kind of want to give you guys some statistics that were interesting to me. So 72%, well, first, the statistics are showing right now that marriage and divorce rates are going down. So divorce rates are going down, which seems like, oh, that's a good thing, you know. But 72% of American adults were married in 1960, 50% in 2008. And 40% of Americans believe that marriage is becoming obsolete now. And so, you guys being here is huge. It's huge. And my husband and I, we made an agreement when we first got married that every year we're gonna do something for our marriage. Counseling, we've been to counseling three times in the course of our marriage over a period of time. And it's been really helpful to continue, like you guys, just keep on going at it. You don't just learn everything all at once, you know? I just wanted to encourage you guys with that. I'm going to have one of you guys open up your Bible or iPhone or whatever and read Matthew 25, 14 through 30. Any volunteers? There's no notes in there if you're looking for me. Does anybody want to read that out loud?
What was the verse again?
14 through 30, 25.
14. In Matthew.
Matthew 25, 14.
14 through 30. 30. For it will be like a man who goes on a journey, who called his servants and entrusted to them his property. To one, he gave 5 talents, to another, 2. Another one, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. He who had received 5 talents went at once and traded with him, and he made 5 talents more. So also he who had the 2 talents made 2 talents more. But he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of the servants came and settled accounts with him. And he who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 talents more, saying, Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here I have made 5 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. And also he who had the 2 talents came forward saying, Master, you delivered to me 2 talents. Here I have made 2 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. He also who had received the 1 talent came forward, saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid it. Here you have what is yours. But his master answered him, You wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown, and gather where I have scattered no seed. Then you ought to have invested with bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For everyone who has will more be given, and he who will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. Into that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Thanks. We're in Matthew 25, just giving us. So what, if you guys could put a one word theme to this, what would it be? Does that make sense? Yes. Did you get that from the questions? No, you just thought it in your own head. All right. So why do you think I would choose that word for those three topics? Anyone? I'll answer. Because just like faith, how all of life is faith, all of life is stewardship as well. Everything that we've been given, we push through and we're called to steward everything. Because everything is a gift from God. So I'm going to go through these 5 points, and then we're going to push through the three topics through the lens of stewardship. And then we're going to have the questions, go through those questions, and then we'll have a Q&A. So get ready. First five things that stood out to me in this, which I think apply to marriage so well, is the parable teaches us that success is a product of our work, which that's obvious. You know, it doesn't come easy, but sometimes we think, especially in marriage, this should come easy. This should just be natural. Well, it's not. Two, parable teaches us that God gives us everything we need to do with what he has called us to do. That to me is incredibly encouraging, that like the person that's sitting next to you or your significant other, God's called you and equipped you to serve them and to love them and has laid everything out before you on this. The third one, not all are created equal. I think, Jason, you talked about knowing yourself last week. Did you do that?
Being a student or a spouse, you mean?
Yeah, or in yourself. You didn't talk about being a...
No. Neil talked a second week, I think, about complementarianism. You talked about your spouse being a gift for your sanctification.
Okay. So just like what he was talking about, like knowing your spouse, being a student of your spouse, you need to be a student of yourself. And marriage is a great way for that. And marriage is a way of like of that mirror of saying like, oh, this is who I really am. But so not all of us are created equal in marriage. And Andy, my husband Andy, has a lot. We are probably the most opposite people that you will meet. But we come to the table with different gifts, different baggage. We have a lot of different baggage that we bring. But it's so in weaknesses and strengths. So it's so important to say, okay, God, you've given me this to steward it well. Like you've given me this. We don't have false humility saying, oh, you're better than that, you know, or pride of like maybe a husband being prideful saying like, I'm supposed to do the finances. But really his wife is better at it, you know, and just letting her do it. And so knowing like together we are one, we're each different. And we bring different things to the table. And we're responsible for that. That baggage, you're responsible for it with the Lord's grace to work through it. You know, it's not your wife's responsibility, your husband's responsibility to fix you. It's yours. So that to me is like, I could teach a whole, I would do like 2 sessions on that with a couple. Number 4, we work for our master, not our own selfish purposes. It does not belong to them. Like finances, obviously, these are not ours. Kids, not ours. Sex, not ours. So I'll move on. We are held accountable how we fulfill our earthly callings. Not about it. So this talk wasn't about work-based salvation or righteousness-based. It's like, this is what I've given you. Now, how are you going to walk with it? And so the first two, they were given different amounts, and they honored the Lord and obeyed him in it. The third one, it proved that he wasn't even saved. He didn't even know the Lord. And not only that, like his heart motive was fear, and he didn't trust him. So, So just kind of have those five things in this topic as we go, we push through. Which one would you think would be the first obvious one topic to start on? In line of stewardship. Money, finances. So that's where we'll go. So a couple of things before we go into finances, and that I would like make sure with any couple I'm mentoring or counseling that we hit is, and I talked about this a little bit earlier, all these things, these three things, if there's conflict in your marriage or between each other, it's not the thing you're having conflict over. So if a couple comes in and says, oh, finances, we're struggling with finances, that may be true, but that's the presentation problem. I don't know if there's any counselors in here, but presentation problems is like, this is what I have. And usually it takes a session or two and to get really to what the heart issue is. And so, usually there's selfish desires in the heart. There's fear, like this man, the third man. He hid his money because there was fear. He was fearful and didn't want to trust. And so if y'all are experiencing tension or fear or whatever in your marriage, ask yourself, be a good steward of your heart and ask yourself, what is actually going on? What is it? What is this pushing on, this insecurity? What is going on? So you continue to manage your money. You continue to discipline and love your kids. You continue to have sex, but always remembering there's deeper motives in your heart for what's going on. My friend Jordan, I just agreed recently to do this missions thing, but I have to raise support. And all of a sudden, all this fear kind of raised, like, ooh, kind of came up in me. And I was talking to my very best friend, Jordan, and she's like, Lauren, you have always been afraid of finances and the control that you have over them, the security that you have in them. And it's so true. And the Lord is using, it's not the issue, oh, I have to go raise support. That's not the issue that's causing the problem. The issue is my fear and lack of trust in the Lord and that false sense of security that I have with finances. And so that's just an example of that. And so as we're talking about this, we're going over the surface of finances and kids and sex. And there'll be things that, especially maybe with sex, things that rise up in you that you're like, I don't know what that is. And just be sensitive and tender to that. So all of these, I'll give you tools and stuff and we'll talk about tools, but they're always going to be changing. I mean, you guys can probably attest to this, that if you get something down with kids, it's going to change the next day. Or finances, your job will change or your needs will change. Sex, it's like you got a rhythm going and then you have a baby and then you don't have sex for 6 weeks. Just if y'all didn't know that, putting it out there. So get ready for that. So it's always changing. So hold these things loosely. My husband and I pray for being way more creative and smarter than we are so that we're able to adapt quickly in circumstances. All right, so finances. 2 Corinthians 9:6-7. The point of this, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. Whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. If each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. Again, everything you have belongs to God, given to you to give back to him. What do you guys think the worldview of Denver is about finances? You guys are super quiet. I need y'all to talk. Remember, I'm a counselor. I am not a teacher.
Worldview of Denver.
Of over finances.
Expensive.
Yeah.
Housing prices are rent are incredibly expensive now.
Mm-hmm. How do they view them in a way that it's ours? Like, this is mine. You know, I work hard so I get to own the best house here, you know, or just kind of like what the view of it.
Or I work hard so I get to go play in the mountains.
Yes. Yeah. It's just a means to, and it's mine to control.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think that older people have that, like, active, competitive, I get to go play in the mountains, and, yeah, maybe not that.
Boulder, for sure. Those Boulder people. Yeah, but, so it's important for us to look at what the worldview is of the culture around us, because that's definitely impacting and going pretty often going counter to what Scripture is telling us. So we are called as believers to render back to God that which is His already. And so that means we're called to live within our means, but even less than that. In Malachi 3, it talks about not harvesting your crop all the way to the border so that you will have enough to give back to him. I think in Ruth, Boaz didn't harvest all the way back, and that's how they met each other. She was reaping that area. Anyway, so I don't know, that is a lot of trust there with the Lord. You know, it's a lot, it can push on a lot of fear that you have of providing for your family, and it's just hard. Two, we are called to work. Genesis, Adam is called that he has to work, and it's a good thing. We are co-creators with the Lord. We are made in his image. We're image bearers of the Lord, so we're called to work. 1 Thessalonians 3:7 through 10, Paul discusses how we are to work each day and provide. Paul discusses how he worked each day and provided for his own needs. He was an apostle, and so normally they would ask the church to provide, but he chose not to do that because at the time, the men in that church were not working. They believed that Jesus was going to come back, and they didn't. So he used it as an example to show them, like, it's good to work. 1 Timothy 5:8, it talks about that. It says, but if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his household, he has denied the faith and worse than an unbeliever. That's really harsh. But it pushes on that pressure point also as well in Denver, that we get to do the job that we feel like we want to do. If we don't feel like it, then I'm not going to do it, you know, or it pushes on our identity as, oh, I went to school all of these years and I'm going to do what I studied. I know that was really hard for me, but God has just called us to work. And when there's no other job, we still have to work. And there's definitely seasons of unemployment, physical injury that create complications, and where the church and other people can provide for that. But those should be the exception, not all the time. So that is finances. Sorry, I'm just plowing through. Our next one is sex. I love talking about sex because it makes people feel so uncomfortable. And most of the time in my counseling session, I just try to get the people to talk about it so that they are able to talk about it as a couple. I've had a friend that they had a code word, her and her husband had a code word for sex. Just don't do that. Just practice talking about it. If y'all ever read books about sex, read it out loud so it's comfortable for you guys to talk about it, because it's an important part of your marriage and your relationship that you're going to have to work on. And again, it's ever changing. Yes.
Did their code word make it even less awkward for them to talk about it?
I don't. It's somebody
like
that you long. Know.
Huh? It feels like it would make it more awkward.
At least it was something was coming out, but yeah.
I guess that's true.
What was their code word?
I don't know. I don't even remember. I just remember being like, okay. People do some weird things around sex. Like, yeah. So.
I feel like it's like the Friends episode where. Do you remember watching?
Yes, I watched it the other night.
Monica uses the word flower to refer to the word sex.
So
she can't say the word.
I'm sure. Yeah, that's a normal word that a lot of people use. So, sex. Yep. We are created as sexual beings. There's like so much research out there that shows as newborns that we are sexually aroused right when we're given birth, like when we have given, like as newborns. So if we deny that part of us, if we think it's dirty, if we think it's inappropriate, it's how God intended it to be. So get that. If that is any part of your growing up history, that needs to be fought and kind of get out of your mind. I talked about that. So again, the question, what is Denver's worldview of sex? Am I asking that right, Jason? He's not listening.
Not an equal in Denver,
you said. Yes. Not just Denver, but that's where we are. Huh?
I was just saying that statistic you were talking about where marriage is becoming obsolete. It's no longer seen as a just seen as a marriage thing. It's just seen as
something you do.
It's interesting. There's a billboard on Sheridan probably like 2 years ago, and I think this has to do with sex and with parenting. But there was a billboard on Sheridan where it was a couple of very young-looking couples that were on this billboard together, and it said, I'm trying to think of the word. What's the word where men get snipped? Basically, where you have your
vasectomy.
Vasectomy. Thank you. It said vasectomy. Vasectomy is the new cool.
Oh.
These people were probably in their early to mid-20s. Mid-20s, probably. So essentially, there's two things you can say there. One is, I can do whatever I want with my sex life with no repercussions. The other one has to do with kids are not really that big deal.
Yeah.
So I think that's how.
Not a blessing, yeah.
That's one way how sex can be.
Yeah, I think, so 80% or more college students are having sex with like 9. I think the average for men is 9 and the average for women is 7 by the time they get through college. I think it's self-satisfaction. It's like the worldview, like this is for me, I have a right to this. This is what my desires are. It's looked at as a need rather than a gift. Sex is viewed as something that is not important and at the same time, like the ultimate thing, you know? And so sex and parenting, I think we're really have to take our thoughts captive for and retrain our thoughts a lot from what our history is, what our experiences are, and what our culture is constantly telling us, and really have a biblical worldview of it, and evaluate, what really am I thinking about this? What really am I demonstrating to my significant other in light of this? I want to be sensitive here to also say, like, every single one of you has a history when it comes to sex, from what your parents taught you, to if there's abuse. 1 in 3 people have been abused. So I'm not, like, this isn't light to me. It's not light at all. So I just want y'all be aware of that with your partner as well. Like, they have a lot of history there, and be sensitive to it, even if you don't understand it. So 1 Corinthians 7, 1-6. Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, but because of the temptation of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. Bam, right there. Don't have sex before marriage. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise a wife to her husband, for the wife does not have authority over her own body, but a husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourself to prayer, but then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. The one thing that we can all agree upon, even though it may not feel like it, is that sex is a gift from God. And we need to treat it as such.
That term sexual immorality covers a lot of territory.
Mm-hmm.
It even appears in Revelation. It says the sexually immoral will not enter the kingdom of heaven. And, you know, that's I think that society views sex as a pretty casual thing.
Oh, yeah.
And of all kinds, and I know as a man, I struggle with my thoughts. Or Jesus said, if you look at a woman in lust, you committed adultery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's sexual immorality right
yep.
there. You know, so it's like, it's kind of like everywhere.
Yeah, and it's so hard.
It's we learned a lot of this from our parents, hopefully. Just their modeling of the marriage. You don't learn much about sex. I didn't learn much about sex with my parents, I tell you that.
How many did? Who? Raise your hand if your parents talked to you about sex. Can you believe? Yeah.
And I raised two kids, and I didn't do a real good job of that myself. So.
Well,
it's an interesting thought, though, that term sexual immorality. Just we're all probably guilty of some kind of sexual immorality.
Oh, yeah. It starts within your heart. The word for pornography is porneia, and it's something, the Greek word for it, and it starts in your heart. So when people say pornography, like, when did you look at pornography? It's not the act of looking at the computer for it. You know, it's what started in your heart for it. So, but the Lord is good, and he's redemptive, and anyway, it's good. So thank you for sharing that. And being open. So to be a steward of sex is to show that sexual union is an act of loving service and ministry to our respective mate. There's a lot of research that's coming out that is showing what our brains actually do when we have sex with our partner. And in the oneness that comes, it's like all these chemicals are washing over in our brain, like the oxytocin and all this stuff, that they're saying it's like a glue, like an attachment that is happening when you have sex with another person. That this is like secular scientists that are showing it. And it goes to show like that verse when Paul's talking about not having sex with a prostitute, because then you become one with that prostitute. And I think the research is also showing that the what it does when you break apart from that partner, like how the pull that it happens in your brain and the hurt that it happens. So, God is in all of it, not just the physical part, but what happened. I mean, not just in the act of it, but in like the brain chemistry of it. Sexual serving is meant to be a joyful and selfless act. And if you abstain, it should be a mutual agreement. Andy, my husband, kept saying, like, you need to explain this to men, like, a little bit more. So I told you, like, so not only is our, as women, there's different seasons in your marriage sexually. There will be times that you want it more, or your husband wants it more, or whatever. And you need to be in agreement with each other of like, okay, when are we not going to do it? And when are we going to do it? You know, and I know at the beginning of marriage, it seems awkward to talk about sex and like planning it out, but like, it's helpful to be able to talk about, okay, let's aim for 3 times a week, or let's aim for like after you have that baby. Are you good, you know, to have sex? You know, just being really honorable to your spouse of when and why, and talking about like, maybe why aren't you wanting to have it? You know, there might be reasons and things that you're doing that she doesn't really like, or he doesn't really like, you know? And so just being open and communicating about it. Faithfulness in this is a ministry to your spouse and strengthens your marriage against the temptation of sex. Of Satan. I don't really know what happens. Like the scientists that are saying like that it makes you one, but it does something to your relationship that brings unity and oneness and being known. When Adam laid with Eve, that word is yada, that laying, and it means being known. Like they knew each other. And so it's just a beautiful way for us to know and to come together. And so it's so much more than just getting our sexual passions and needs met there. But it's a way of like laying down our right, laying down our bodies, and sacrificing and serving the other person in that way. So yeah, so it goes beyond our emotions and it goes beyond our sexual passions. Were you gonna say that?
That's the closest I feel to Eden, like that mm-hmm. pre-Edenic state of they were naked and had no worries and just sort of ran around the garden.
Yeah.
I get a glimpse of that in knowing my wife, but yeah, that's the closest I ever get to it.
Yeah, and hopefully, because I think that being known, what they wanted and they desired for it is to be known and unashamed in all areas. You know, and that unashamed verse right there in Hebrew, it doesn't mean that we felt ashamed because of the way our body looked, but the other person wasn't causing shame. And so, and it happens so often, you know, in sex or even finances and raising kids. Anyway, we're way running out of time. Okay, but yeah, thank you. It is. I don't know. It's like such a mystery. I feel like when it's like done in such an honorable way. Okay, we're gonna move on to kids. Why do you guys think raising kids is important for engaged couples and people without kids to talk about? That's kind of an obvious question. It's just good to prepare. Okay, we're moving. I'm way out of time. Oh, did you have anything? Oh. 2 points I want to bring up. Proverbs 22:6, raise a child on the way it shall go. When they're old, they will not depart from it. The way they should go, that means in Hebrew, the bent in which God has already created them. This has really changed the way that Andy and I parent and the way that we come. So this verse, a lot of people think, even Jason was talking about it, that we think of, I'm going to discipline them and the way they will go, they won't depart from God later on and da 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 da. Well, the bent means that God has already put something in them for how he has created them to be. And all we do is steward them, and all we do is push them along in what God has already directed them to be. That hits on so many areas of us as parents. We come in with a right of, you are going to be this. You are going to prove that I'm a good parent. You're going to prove that all this hard work is worth it. And so you better act right. And it proves, it pushes on the inconvenience of being a parent. It is so inconvenient being a mom and a dad. I mean, I'm like so tired today because my son just decides to wake up every 2 hours, you know, but that's how the Lord intended it to be. My daughter is like, my oldest is a mystery to me. She is so different. And if I come in assuming that she's like me because she's a female, because she has my same genes, I am wrong, and I am dishonoring what God has called me to steward. So I have to spend a lot of time with my kids. I have to say no to a lot of things, because if I need to know their heart individually and know what makes them tick while they're discovering it as well. A good example of this for me was, my oldest has been in 3 different schools, and she's in second grade. And she, yeah. So the first school was ACA. It was a wonderful private school. We loved it. And when she went into kindergarten, I put her in this Escuela de Guadalupe. It was a Catholic school, diverse, dual language. I'm like, this is awesome. I would love this school. You know, this would be a perfect fit for me if I was a kindergartner. So of course I thought it would be a perfect fit for her. So she's in there, and she got home at 4:30. We were doing homework till 6 as a kindergartner. She wasn't able to process well. She was kind of shutting in on herself. And in my mind, I was like, why is this not, like, do I push her through because it's so good for her to learn about diversity? Is it so good for her to learn another language? And I was like crying out to the Lord, because if we pulled her out of that school, we weren't getting back in. Like, in because of the language thing. So I was crying out to the Lord, like, what do I do? And all I heard him say is, like, I know her name. I know her name. Like, she is not mine. Sorry, she's not mine. I have no right over her, or no promise over her that I will have her forever, or that I get a right to say where she goes. And that is so scary. And so I had to come to terms with the fact of, like, wow, I was putting her in the school because I like it. Like, I love it. I still love it. And so now we're at a different school. It's a little bit boring to me. It's great, but it's a good fit for her. And the Lord is walking us through. And so I just want you guys, when you guys have kids, just remember, it's not about you, not your identity. It's about who they are. And you also have to know your own bent and know yourself to know what pushes on you. 2, Let each of us not look at our own interests, but also the interest of others. So again, parenting is really inconvenient. We're called to do the hard thing. It is so much easier to not discipline. It is. My daughter carried around 3 purses yesterday in Target when we were doing the like Samaritan purse box, like the box for the kids. And I'm like, it'd be so easy to just buy those for her as we're buying presents for other people, you know, but I had to endure the fit on the floor and everybody looking at me because it's hard. And Jason was an example I think about, and I asked permission if he could share. But Jason, his oldest, Sean, I'm like really emotional today because I'm relaxed, but was in the hospital for a year. When he was a baby, a year? Not a year.
No, he was in the hospital for 4 weeks when he was a year
old. Okay. Like life-threatening thing, had a shunt in his head. correct me if I'm wrong, I was sharing whatever. But that year afterwards, I mean, can you imagine? So that year after, when they turn a year, I mean, you need to start disciplining them when they turn a 2, or like you're kind of backtracking a little bit. Could you imagine disciplining a kid that has a shunt in his head, almost died? It'd be so hard. But one of the things that you guys learned was we didn't discipline them, right? And so you had to kind of make up. What were you gonna say?
Yeah, we felt that. And so that whole probably next year, if not more than that, we didn't do much discipline with him. And then what it did was it set him back years in trying to discipline him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have to learn early that it's not about them, that there's an authority over them. There will always be an authority over him. Always. God will but always be over. We live in a country, there's a government. So it's so good for them to know it's not about them.
I feel like you're right around 9 months or so, you really start seeing their heart.
Yeah. Flint, my son, my baby, I'm like, say mama. And he looks at me and goes, daddy. I'm like, what are you doing toying with my heart this way? Anyway, so that's all. There's so much more we could talk about. I hope it made sense. Those questions, I would like you guys to talk about them, think about them. Make them personal, the stewarding, those things. And put it through the lens of like, what is my background? Really, what's my baggage I'm bringing into this? What are my thoughts? What is God? And make it rub against what God's called you to. So, is that where you want us to go?
Yeah, so let's...
So sorry. I am so over time.
You're good.
Andy told me it was a 10-minute talk when I practiced last night.
There you go.
He was wrong.
Why do you say 15 minutes?